Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Welcome to this edition of A Climate Hawk's Companion. My name's Ted McIntyre. Today is August 28th, 2013. Down in Washington, D.C., there are lots of people celebrating the famous March on Washington from 1963, where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. When I was in college, I took a course called The American Civil Religion, which was basically focused on the sacredness of America's founding doctrines and the things that have united us through the years, regardless of our religious inspiration. Today is an anniversary of something that is about as sacred as it gets in America. The March on Washington was a profound and transformative event for America and should be rightly celebrated. But there was another event today that is perhaps also seminal in its own way. The Energy Exodus March from the coal-powered Brayton Point power plant in Fall River, Massachusetts, in the direction of Cape Wind, the new wind turbine power plant proposed off of Cape Cod, commenced. Today was the first day, the first 10 miles, although I'll tell you it seemed like 100 miles, but the first 10 miles. It's a symbolic march. I had the good opportunity to walk with the people on that march today, from Brayton Point to the North Dartmouth, the first way station. It was fascinating. I met a bunch of people. I didn't capture all of the conversation, which I wish I did, but I didn't capture all the conversation, but I did capture some of it. And so what I will do today is to present that essentially unedited. What you will hear are voices from the Energy Exodus March from Brayton Point to Cape Wind. Various people, I want you to remember that these people, I took them by surprise. They hadn't planned anything. They gave me an honest and heartfelt description of why they were on the march. There's road noise in the background, but it's not terrible. I hope you listen to the folks that are represented here, because I found it fascinating. I hope you find it fascinating as well.
All right, let's start again. I can't guarantee the quality of this recording.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your name?
Mike Ferriter.
And what organization are you with?
Polluters Pay Initiative.
Polluters, so that's a Massachusetts-based group, right?
Yes.
And so what are you trying to do?
We are trying to get our government here in the state to get a carbon price that can be worked on via either the Conroy-Barrett bill, or
which is a carbon tax,
yes, or the Global Warming Solutions Act, which is already in place, that the governor has already done studies on to find out what is the reasonable amount so that businesses won't fail, the environment will get better, jobs will happen for the green community,
right,
and it'll be all a plus for everyone.
What's the mechanism in the Global Warming Solutions Act that you're looking at? I mean, I know there's studies, but there's no funding mechanism that goes through the GWSA.
That's correct. We're feeling that the GWSA rate is so low, it's unfortunate because it could have a big influence. Not only an influence, it could be creating something in our state that can be used as a model nationwide. So Global Warming Solutions charges electric producers a lot more money. That's a first step in the process. Next, we have to tax gasoline, oil, home heating oil, etc., as in the Conroy Barrett bill.
And so what's your sort of strategy for working around the state? I know you're trying to create networks of groups that want to focus on this. What are you thinking?
We're feeling that we want to combine different environmental groups, unions, civic organizations, all under one umbrella. So we're all trying to push for one same unified price. And to do that, we're going to have to educate people on a citywide, townwide, municipality-wide level so that they can branch out to their own local people, educate them, then push our legislators, particularly our governor. But the legislators can push the governor as well.
So tell me, do you have a website? I mean, you so far learned that you've got that kind of infrastructure in place?
We're really formative right now, Ted. We're actually looking for an environmental group that, we can become part of for the 501c3 that they have, and we can reach out through them. So we don't have that yet, no. But we're working hard at pulling things together as quickly as possible. Any help from MCAN, the better.
Okay, well, right, so it's 11:10. This is the second discussion. So I'm walking along talking to a guy named Shanti, which I just gave you a name away. Let's start again. Anyway, how you doing?
Good.
What's your name?
My name's Shanti, S-H-A-N-T-I,
okay.
Gaia, G-A-I-A.
All right, excellent. And so what brings you here? That we're on the walk to the energy exodus. Why are you here today?
So there's a lot of reasons that I'm here today. Kind of the number one being that
the nation is
humans are living in a way that's not sustainable. And it's part of my life's purpose to be part of that process to the great transition to a life-sustaining society.
And you see this walk as part of that, building that kind
this
of...
This is one drop in the ocean that's needed to get us there.
We're now walking through Fall River and basically a nice but urban street. It's a city. People are beeping their horns as they go by, giving us the high sign, so that's a good thing.
So that's kind of the core reason. I do help run. I'm on the administrative committee of a group called Climate Action Now Massachusetts.
Okay, where's that based?
Pioneer Valley, Western Massachusetts, coalition of individuals and groups working for climate issues.
And so we were talking before, you mentioned you live in a pretty interesting town?
Sure. Well, I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
There's one other, you know, big reason that I'm here, and that is that kind of the idea of walking as a prayer for a positive action is something that's a strong practice of mine. I've actually walked thousands of miles on peace walks in over 20 countries.
Really?
So this type of...
Name what the most exotic three countries. 20 countries, that's a lot.
The most exotic three were Cambodia, where I walked across the entire country of Cambodia with 200 Buddhist monks and nuns, and we walked through an active war zone for the first 10 days, and that was really exotic and unique. Walked through portions of Iraq after we had demolished them in the first Gulf War, and then actually walked in portions of Bosnia while the war was still happening.
Wow.
So those are probably the three most.
So you're a bona fide, this is not, this is sort of a walk in the park today, right?
Yes, and so I've done about six different peace walks, three of them really major, maybe more than that, because there's a bunch of little ones that I've been part of, so this is a practice that calls to me.
Well, it's funny, I we do podcasts. This will probably end up in a podcast. Yeah. I keep referring to Gandhi's salt march as this symbolic thing that has always resonated with me. So I respect your connection to this kind of activity.
Yeah, thank you.
Good way to go.
So you were asking me about the place where I live. I live in a small eco-village. It's called Sirius, spelled like the star. It's in a place called Shutesbury, Massachusetts, in Western Mass, about 15 minutes from UMass Amherst. And it's been there since the mid-70s. And although I visited the first time about 15 years ago, I've lived there 2.5 years. And it's a great place, about 30 people live there, and it's kind of an experiment in a more sustainable way of living together, cooperatively in a group. And the age range of people there is anywhere from 5 to 93, and we have multiple families.
And it's a compound sort of planned and built in the 70s with
started in the 70s, but it's slowly evolved. Buildings have been added slowly over time. So there's about 14 buildings, and some of them are individual houses where a whole family lives, and others are might be a building where every kind of room is somebody's own room and they share the kitchen. And then there's a 12,000 square foot community center that has a bunch of beds for people who come to stay like the night or the week, because we have a lot of guests. Plus there's some apartments and a couple of yurts, a big mixture of places.
Do you know if it's unique in Massachusetts? I mean, is it, or are there other places you connect to?
So I lived at another place called Earthlands for 5 years, which was an ecological intentional community, which actually ended up dissolving as an intentional community. But there are a couple of other places in Massachusetts similar to Sirius. None exactly alike, but there's a worldwide movement of intentional communities that's been around since the 70s. And it spans anything on the far spectrum on one side to like a hippie commune, to kind of the far spectrum on the other side, a co-housing community, which is a very structured, planned community that may or may not have any other intention besides a more clustered ecological and economical way to live together.
Right.
We're maybe somewhere in the middle. We have a very strong vision for the purpose of the community. And so it's not just people living together to live together. We have a definite purpose to the organization.
I think it's interesting because, I mean, I'm sure everywhere, but here in Massachusetts, I lived in West Roxbury, and there was a Stony Brook Farm, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And then there's Fruitlands up in Concord, and there were all these transcendentalists. I mean, do you see yourself as part of that tradition? Or, I mean, in 200 years, is there going to be a park there that said this was the beginning of the new way? Or is that the hope, or is it just your...
So definitely, I would say that the intentional community movement as a whole was heavily influenced by the transcendental movement, by the utopian movement, and it spawned out of the kind of the great cultural awakening of the 60s. But so there's an intentional community that's world famous that's called Findhorn. That's in Scotland. It's been there for 50 years. And there were four people from America who went to live there in the early 70s. They just loved it so much they wanted to try to create something similar in the U.S. So they came over and started Sirius. And so they were not trying to duplicate, but trying to follow a similar path to Findhorn. And Findhorn, like any other intentional community, has a broad range of influences. Two of those founders are still there.
I think it's very interesting. And I thank you very much for taking the time to share and describe where you're coming from. I think that I appreciate you talking.
Sure, there's a couple other key details I can just give. You could obviously talk about it for a long time, but... We have our own on-site organic permaculture CSA, community-supported agriculture. We generate a lot of our own electricity from solar, and we're putting up some wind generators. We're not off the grid, but we're looking to produce more and more of our own electricity. We have 90 acres with the 30 people living on them, and all 90 acres are held in a community land trust, as well as most of the buildings. We also have a bunch of composting toilets, because it's kind of ridiculous, this idea that you take human waste, which actually can be composted into something to enrich the soil, and you pollute good, clean drinking water with it, and then you process it, and then you go put it somewhere else and pollute ground somewhere else with it.
I just think it's interesting that we have sociologists that go to other cultures and find their taboos, and here in the West, I mean, the idea of waste is this thing nobody wants to talk about, right? And so we do these ridiculous things of wasting, you know, drinkable water to do this thing because no one wants to actually come
to get it away. Just get it away. It's a resource. You know, we turn it back into the soil, not on our vegetable crops, just for safety reasons. Right. Although the way we treat it, it's not, you know, contaminated, but still, we don't put it on vegetable crops, but we turn it back into the soil. So,
good stuff. Good stuff. So let's see. Now, post lunch, we're walking by the Galley Grill. I can see 195 on Route 6, and actually, I'm going to turn this off because I think we may be crossing. Well, let's see. Anyway, let me begin. I'm chatting with a young man named Alex. He's got a Celtics shirt on, and he's carrying a sign that says, "Deval, we've got your backbone. Please close Brayden Point." But tell me, Alex, tell me the story you were just saying. You're 3 weeks back in the U.S. now?
So I was living in Guatemala for a year. My mom had a social textile business as I was growing up, so I was traveling around Guatemala quite a bit when I was younger. And grew to love Guatemala like my mom did, and I volunteered throughout high school at an educational nonprofit called Safe Passage or Camino Seguro.
Uh huh. Speaking of Safe Passage, we're gonna cross through six here, so.
And then I two summers ago, I had an internship with a sustainable development organization.
Uh-huh.
They were piloting some new solar systems from a Guatemalan solar energy company called Quetzol.
What were you doing? You were helping?
I was, the sustainable development organization was through a program called Social Entrepreneur Corps.
Okay.
And it's a program that brings college students and educates them in sustainable development work.
Okay.
They were prototyping using these solar energy systems of Quetzol, this Guatemalan solar energy company. And I was interested, and that was two summers ago, and I was like, all right, I'll email you about next summer. And so I did. So this past summer in 2012, I had an internship with the solar energy company.
So what were you actually doing? Were you installing it, or were you selling it, or
did
you go to a house in Guatemala and help them put this on the roof?
Yep, did that, and also did some market studies on new products such as solar refrigeration for small stores that were off the grid.
Uh-huh. And what was the justification you were telling me before about why it made sense for the people to put solar on their house, or why it was worthwhile?
Sure. Yeah. So like I said, I had this internship and I was working on those market studies, and then I said, when I graduated in December from Babson College, I said I'd really like to go back and make a world of difference down there. And so I went back starting in December of 2012, and that's been where I've been working. And the people down there buy candles. It's very scary to see their kids trying to study with candles in their hands and getting wax all over their hands and arms.
And you said that it's 50 cents to recharge the phone?
Yeah, so the small solar panel, which is 10 watts,
okay,
with a battery, all a plug-and-play system, is roughly $200. And they use microfinance to pay for it in 24 payments. And can cut their cost by 50% in the sense that they don't have to pay for candles. They have a much higher quality of light as well. And they can charge their cell phones in the solar energy kit. So instead of walking an hour or two to a nearby other town that has electricity and paying 50 cents, they can do it in their house and save quite a bit of money.
So that essentially justifies the 10 watts of solar power.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really just for two or three lights for their house and then to charge cell phones, which is really all they need.
Well, that's interesting. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
Rose is going to Smith.
Right, so we're back on the march. We're looking at 195 on a side road, Bedford Road, and I'm talking to Carolyn Barthel. So, Carolyn, tell me. Say who you are and tell me why you're doing this.
I'm Carolyn Barthel from Mendon, Massachusetts. I am doing this because we need to do something to be able to change policies so that we can have a sustainable future. We really need to wake up everyone to the urgency that we have, that we just don't have time. And we can't wait until suddenly everything looks so terrible that we are going to finally get around to doing something.
So tell me this, are you having fun here?
Oh, I'm having a blast.
Tell me about it. What does it look like? What do the people look like? Who have you met?
Oh, I've met people from Brookline and all over the state, and I've been just talking about I've had one conversation I had with a woman who is she's the head of the Mothers Out Front program, where the mothers are, I relate to this as a mother. I want a sustainable future for my children, and so it's been really interesting talking with her. And
what are they trying to do?
They're trying to galvanize mothers to recognize that their children will not have futures.
How are they doing that?
I
got to talk to her.
Yeah, you need to talk to her.
I
haven't gotten that far with her. She was telling me though that there is a man at the Kennedy School of Government who has done research and on what it takes to get movements rolling and how people expand their interest and people expand their activity in terms of working with the movement and how it galvanizes people to action. And she was curious about why I was doing this, and what led me to walk 6 miles, 60 miles over 6 days, and I'm 61, so a lot of sixes.
Well, thank you very much for, we'll cut that last part because you don't look 61 at all. All right, there you go. Thank you very much. So just start where you were, then we'll go back and fill in later on. So you were describing why the Friends, which I guess is Quakerism.
Yep.
Okay, so mm-hmm. What's the motivating moral point that would bring someone like yourself to this kind of a march?
Well, I'll take a step back and start with our form of worship, which is silence. With the idea that anyone who feels led to can stand up and speak. And the idea behind that is that everyone can have their own direct connection with God.
Uh-huh.
And it's like a ministry of all believers kind of thing, where any person can potentially have a message for the group. So it's not like the people who have a special title or a special kind of education are the ones who lead the congregation. It's really everybody.
Uh-huh.
So out of that, or along with that, comes the idea of that of God in everyone.
Okay.
Which is basically just what it sounds like, that every person is sacred, every person is from God, and so that's kind of the foundation of a lot of our sort of philosophy and action.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you start from the sacredness of all human beings, pacifism is a pretty logical correlation, that if every person is sacred, how can one human being kill another?
Uh-huh.
So that's something that we're known for and have been known for a long time. So as far as Earth Care, starting with all human beings are sacred, I kind of extended out to the whole earth is sacred too. And really this climate change crisis is a matter of our survival as a species.
Uh-huh.
So I just feel like it's, you know, given the Quaker worldview that I have,
it's a natural.
This just seems like, yeah, what a place where I need to be taking action, given that I know that humanity is threatened.
So, Ty, you were telling me before about what actions you, I mean, what sorts of things you do. You said you are visiting other friends' meeting houses to kind of expand on the message, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I am with a group of 5 young adults in New England who are the Young Adult Friends Climate Working Group. And we go around and we visit Quaker meetings, and usually what happens is maybe 2 or 3 of us will tell our story about our own life and our own wrestling with the climate crisis. You know, pretty much every one of us has a story about the realization of the enormity of climate change and trying to figure out how to take action in a way that makes sense without getting totally stuck in fear and despair, which can get easy to get stuck in around this stuff.
Uh-huh.
So we usually go and we tell our stories, and then we have some open time. Sometimes people will ask us questions, or we'll have worship sharing, which is when people speak out of the silence. And you know, can
you find a good response usually?
Yeah, yeah, it's been really good.
And so you said you would pedal down from the Boston area to a meeting someplace in New England, and that's great.
Yeah, I mean, we don't always bike to the meetings that we visit, but the annual meeting of all the Quakers in New England is in Rhode Island, and we've been organizing a bike ride the past couple of years to bike down there from Boston. So.
Kathleen, thank you very much.
Yep.
All right, so now this was about 3 in the afternoon, walking along. And so, hi, what's your name?
Jordan Melsna.
Okay, and what? Why are you here today? We're somewhere in North Dartmouth, so right, walking along a road with the energy exodus. Why are you here?
Yeah, I am walking because, to me, this march represents the transition we need to make. From here on out, it needs to be renewable energies that we have ready to go now, instead of the coal and gas.
So we were just talking about the new natural gas infrastructure that's been proposed in Massachusetts. So what's your take on that?
Right. Well, pretty much all new fossil fuel infrastructure in Massachusetts would be gas infrastructure.
Okay.
And it's not talked about very much, but huge projects are up to happen. Without being in the public eye very much, new gas plants, an export terminal to put gas all over the world where prices are higher, the expansion of the Algonquin pipeline.
And this is not in direct response to Obama's Bridge the Future thing, but it's part of this use of natural gas until the magic time we have renewables, right? So
it's really just, it's because of the gas glut that we now have, especially because of untraditional
right,
methods of extraction here now. But there's no opposition to it almost, because the gas industry has been able to do virtually all of their branding and demonize coal and oil coming out looking better.
Yep.
When the truth is, the reality is that when it comes to climate, gas is just as bad and probably far worse than coal.
Because of the methane leakage.
When you account for methane leakage.
Yep. And tell me, the methane leakage is what? The methane leaks out at the fracking site and along the transition lines?
Usually not the big pipelines, but local distribution lines are very leaky.
Uh-huh.
And
so what's wrong with that?
Well, methane is a potent greenhouse gas.
More so than CO2.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Especially when you talk in the short term. Within 20 years, it's 70 to 100 times
more potent than
more
the
potent
CO2.
Than, yeah.
So which is why it suddenly washes out the advantage that methane has over coal from the CO2 level.
In terms of CO2. That's why you always need to talk in terms of carbon equivalents and not just carbon dioxide, because it's true that, well, because what the gas companies will do that allows them to use the word cleaner is that it's true that when it burns, it releases less carbon dioxide. But if it goes unburned, it's a different story. But in addition to that, even if there were no leakage, which would be a feat, expanding gas, keeping on the track we're on, eliminating, you know, without leakage, what would be dirtier fossil fuels, we would still put ourselves far above tipping points in climate. So this isn't a solution in any shape or form. It's maybe, you know, if we made the infrastructure better, it could be slightly less efficient at wrecking our climate, but it'll still wreck our climate. So
I heard you say before, no bridge to the, it's not a bridge to the future, right?
Yeah.
The argument would be that we shouldn't be building this infrastructure that we're going to be stuck with for a long time, that we should go directly to wind turbines and whatnot.
Right. The name of the campaign under 350 Massachusetts is Bridge to Nowhere.
All right. Well, thank you very much for chatting.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Let's see.
It's a big fraud. It's like the...
So what's your name?
Turner Bledsoe.
And you're from?
Hingham.
Right, and we're marching through North Dartmouth. It's about, 3:30, 4:15 on Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
So tell me, why are you here?
Well, I got absolutely motivated by Bill McKibben. And that started a long time ago. But what really ignited my fervor, let's say, is that...
Let me just say in preface, when I asked this young gentleman why he was here, he says, because I'm mad.
Well,
so your fervor, tell me about your fervor.
Yeah, well, it's the fact that the numbers show that the fossil fuel industry is fraudulently marketing their value. And all of the reserve they've got, 80% of it has to be left in the ground if our climate is going to stabilize.
Right.
And yet they are behaving as though it's going to last forever. You listen to their advertisements, they've got enough reserves to provide wonderful energy for generations to come. Well, that just ain't so. And we need to speed the transition from fossil fuels to non-carbon energy.
What do you think of the divestment movement?
Absolutely important.
Well, tell me this. Do you think that individuals can do that? Because I've been looking at my own stuff, trying to figure out how can I move out of these mutual funds that have, you know, funds in it.
I asked my financial advisor to start looking through the holdings in these mutual funds and steer me away as much as possible. Now, we have an issue in the Unitarian Church with respect to that. The central UUA investment folks have dragged their feet with respect to divesting. But on the argument that they have more power as a big investor in the behavior of the fossil fuel industry.
I saw some articles in the UU World magazine a couple months ago between Fred Small and the other guy, but the two sides of the divestment.
Right.
Is that the kind of thing you're referring to?
That's it. Fred Small's got it right. The moral obligation to get rid of it. And our congregation is interestingly in the same position. Our trustees of investment funds took it to their advisor, and he says, well, you know, if I look back at the last few years, if we had divested, we would be a little better off.
Really?
But it's such a trouble to screen these out that we recommend against it. The congregations in the Unitarian community are up in arms. So our trustees took the same position. So we're going to take it to the congregation as a whole.
Really?
Yeah.
That's excellent. Tell me this. What's your opinion of the possibility? Because this is something I've talked about. I'm not a financial advisor or anything. Do you think there could be a sort of a bust of the oil stocks?
Absolutely.
That flip side is that you stay with something that's going to crash, Yeah, you know, it's better to get out while you can.
Yeah, there's some very interesting studies. There's a group called the Mercer Group, who's looked at the long-range implications of climate change on long-term investment. They've done an analysis by element, and there's absolutely no doubt that the fossil fuel securities are going to decline. It's just that they've done an analysis that says the longer you wait, the more costly it's going to be for the economy that waits. Wow. So there's a Stern report in Great Britain, which did a very thorough, thoughtful analysis of the cost of the implications of letting climate change go its course.
Right.
And it's immensely expensive.
Right, and I think, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Stern report, and I'm sure you understand, was that the discount on future value or something, he was fairly generous, which I tend to agree with, in meaning that we need to value, I mean, I guess I'm not an economist either, but I mean, I know that the discount value that economists apply to future things really can kill the value of taking action now.
Right.
And Stern was more generous, and it makes it much more obvious that we need to take action now.
Right, his recommendation was very strong. And then if you look at the stuff that came out from the PricewaterhouseCoopers analysis, they've been tracking the global decarbonization of the major economies.
Uh-huh.
And every year they track them against the promises that were made last in Copenhagen. And they're woefully behind. Of course, Australia and China are the worst. But Europe, Germany, France, they're way ahead of schedule.
Right.
According to their analysis, on a yearly basis, the worldwide carbon intensity has to diminish by 5.3% a year. Every year that it doesn't make that mark, it has to be more the next year. United States was at 3.3%. France was at 6.something%. Germany even more. So maybe we got to get off the dime or this isn't going to work.
Well, I tend to agree. Anyway, I tend to agree. We're walking by a solar panel array.
Hey,
how cool is that? So now we're on Fonts Corner Road, heading towards 195. It's about 6 o'clock Wednesday night, and we're talking with who? Are we talking with Alex
Salazar Greenstein.
And where do you call home?
Originally, I call Ipswich, Massachusetts, home. As of right now, I live in Northampton.
And so, why are you here on the march? What are you doing?
I am here on the march because I can no longer sit by and wait for government or for legislation to, you know, just be put away in office and not dealt with. And I want to take, you know, action with people who are wanting a change immediately. So,
are you having fun?
I'm having a great time.
I mean, it's an interesting crowd of people, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Only people who are truly passionate for seeing change and great people, though. You know, it's not a hostile environment.
So anybody who wanted to show up for day should, because it's all nice people.
Yeah, yeah. I would encourage anyone who's even just looking for some nice people to talk with, you know, to have an open mind, you know, come
along. Tell me, what kind of stuff do you do around climate work or sustainability, or what's your...
Well, I am in UMass Amherst Divestment Club.
Okay.
And I guess I'm just getting into it, but there's a full schedule agenda for the fall to get events and an action for the 21st of September, which is International
Divestment. Bill McKibben's next date. Right?
Yeah, right. So we're trying to plan.
So tell me, what kind of case do you make? And I was talking with someone else before about this. Do you go to the students first? I mean, I know you're not running it. You're part of the group.
But yeah.
Do you have a philosophy about going to the students first or the administration first?
For what I believe?
Yeah, what do you think they ought to do?
In regards to, well, okay, so I guess I'll start by saying, in regards to students, first to divest and incorporate either local economies, you know, boost those with renewable energy, clean jobs, and really that goes for national and eventually international as well.
Uh-huh.
The I think that in order to have a sustainable future, we'll have to just kickstart this green energy, renewable, solar,
uh-huh,
wind power, in order to just have the basic necessity and human right to clean energy and really to not to just cater to people who can afford it, but
right,
people.
Watch out for it.
Yeah.
So you guys are working to September 21st as your first big sort of event? You haven't been back there yet. I mean, it was still late August, so.
The 10th of September is a day where we're going to hear about the bill on divestment in Boston. So there's carpools.
That's right. There's an event in Boston for the state effort to divest the state government, right?
Ah. So students are definitely planning to go down there. And that's coming up. You know, that's pretty much, you know.
It's like 12 days.
Yeah, it's like right when everyone's getting back to school. So, you know, hopefully classes aren't assigning too much at this point where we can be like, hey, come on, you know.
So you're planning to get guys in there on buses and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, buses or carpool at least, you know. Uh-huh. You gotta be able to change the system through the people, but you gotta get there somehow. So
tell me, you in this march for all 6 days?
Pretty much, I think so, yeah.
Looking forward to sleeping on the hardwood floor for the next few days? You're a young
tent.
Man, I'm sure it won't bother you too
much.
Yeah,
I brought my own tent, so
I'll
be on grass.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Alec, for chatting. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So there you go. That was a small portion of the people that I had the joy to talk to today. I want to thank them all very much for taking the time to chat with me as we marched along the road from Brayton Point to North Dartmouth. I also want to thank Craig Altimos and the Better Futures Project for organizing the march. And remember that this you can still catch the march for the next few days. They'll be going on until Monday when they're down on Cape Cod. If you can get there, go ahead. So we'll close the way we always close, with a special salute to Mike Ferriter, by saying that because we recognize the accountability for our own actions, because we take on the responsibility for building a durable future, and because we see that it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.